thank you for that wonderful welcome. And thank you to Reverend Jesse Jackson for joining us in Madison, Wisconsin for the 90th anniversary of the Capitol Times. Most of you don't need an introduction to Reverend Jackson, but I'll give it to you anyway. Because there are some things people don't always remember about him. And one of those things is that he was born in South Carolina in 1941 into not the easiest of circumstances, but he had a talent, and it wasn't public speaking. He was a brilliant athlete. He turned down a chance to be a professional baseball player to go to college, a good choice, went on a football scholarship, and might well have pursued athletics, but he chose to be a champion of the Lord and was ordained as a minister. Then in 1965, he went down to Selma, Alabama, and marched with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. King, in addition to being a Nobel Peace Prize winner and perhaps the greatest American of most of our lifetimes, recognized talent. And he sent Jesse Jackson to Chicago to take the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to that city, and to recognize that racism was not just a function of the South. Reverend Jackson traveled with Reverend King. He was with Reverend King on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis. After that day, he returned to Chicago, eventually starting Operation Push and becoming immensely active in that city, both in the social life of the city and in the politics of the city. But his politics was never limited to one city or one state or one nation. It is important to recognize that we are tonight in the presence of America's most successful diplomat, certainly of our lifetimes, the man who has freed American hostages in the Middle East and other countries around the world, man who has been an integral player in the Northern Ireland peace process, in efforts to alleviate famine, hunger, all sorts of challenges in Africa, and the person who taught America the name Nelson Mandela and brought the anti-apartheid movement to this country. Reverend Jackson has done so very, very much, but he did something else too, and that was run for President of the United States, not once, but twice, drawing 3.5 million votes in 1984, and doubling that number to 7 million votes in 1988. Reverend Jackson's contribution to the politics of this country is the subject of our discussion tonight. One of the reasons I think that we can say, we would love to say that he just comes to Madison because he likes the town so much. One of the reasons he's here is because, of course, in 1988, there were only two newspapers that endorsed him for president. One was the Philadelphia Daily News, which had good reason to endorse him in a city that had a very large African-American population. If they didn't, they might have gotten in trouble with their readership. The other was the Capitol Times. And we are honored to have you join us tonight, Reverend Jackson.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and thanks for being here. We're gonna go through a number of questions this evening, but we won't take so long that you don't get cake. Reverend Jackson, one of the discussions that's been in play recently about the current presidential race is that one of the candidates, Barack Obama, apparently wrote an essay when he was in kindergarten discussing the possibility he might run for president someday. And I wanted to ask you, when was the first point at which you thought about running for president of the United States?
1983. You know, it really was, grew up in South Carolina and learned to survive in my segregated surroundings. And under oppression, you negotiate your life options. And within that system, your parents insulate you, but don't isolate you. And that was home and church and school. You live in that circle. It was really about survival. At a certain point, I remember coming home, University of Illinois, as a freshman, and couldn't use a public library. And had to do a speech 25 and a 10 minute conference. And the colored library didn't have them in books. So I went to the library and was dismissed. I was saying to my friend at the Central Library, and she would give me books. And I was so delighted. I ran all the way, maybe 2 miles away. I got there, two police just happened to have been there, hanging around the library. I gave her the note, and no one was in the library. So I expected the books. She said, I'll get them to you in 6 days. I need the books now because I'm in South Carolina, I'm in school at Champaign, Illinois. Since the library is empty, can I go to the stacks, heard that term, stacks. She said, 6 days. Police said, you heard what she said, and I got it. And back out the back of the library. And I looked at the sign that said public library. I thought about my father, World War II veteran, good vote. And I felt humiliated and hurt and cried. And went back to school early to do my speech. That summer, I came home, and 7 of us went to the public library. Long story short, we were in jail trying to use the public library. So that was a certain taste of this fight for dignity.
You don't always been in a situation like that. Think about running for president and you can't get in the library.
No, you can't see around the curve till you get to the corner. One step kind of logical leads to the next. The next year, of course, at Champaign, I thought I was in the land of Lincoln. I thought it had a certain meaning that it didn't have. And so it was so hostile. I went to North Carolina A&T the next year. The sit-ins had begun that February. It's interesting about the idea whose time has come. I looked at that sign and couldn't use the library and felt so humiliated. And I said, I didn't know Dr. King, anybody said, this summer I'm going to use this library. While I was making that determination, students said in Nashville, like 200 miles away, were organizing to start a sit-in led by Jim Lawson. Well, they were planning to do it, students in Greensboro did it. I mean, within a 300 mile radius, this bubble was occurring. And so that summer was the library, went to jail. And this kind of continued. And then the sit-ins continued in Greensboro, North Carolina. And then I was going to law school, perhaps, University of North Carolina, out to Duke. And Dr. Proctor convinced me I should go to the seminary. And I left to go to Chicago, so I had to not remain involved because I couldn't do my grad work and be as involved as I was. So I was away for like a year. The next year, Selma, and hooked up with Dr. King at that time. And he left Selma and came to Chicago, where I was already in grad school, and started Breadbasket. And I was just kind of in that rhythm of fighting to expand rights. It was an open housing drive, the public education drive, in the war in Iraq drive. He was killed so suddenly. But that was the unfinished business, and we continued doing basic registration. And in 1983, Harold Washington, we were crying out for an African-American mayor who would be sensitive to our concerns in Chicago. And we thought we could win. Three of our colleagues were arrested at a public housing meeting. And we got them out of jail. And when we got them out of jail, that Sunday morning on the radio show I was doing, someone said, why don't you just boycott Chicago Fest? It's just Jane Byrne's coronation. And say, well,
Jane Byrne was the incumbent mayor. And Harold Washington was challenging in a Democratic primary.
That's right. My instinct was to say, easy for you to say, boycott Chicago Fest. I mean, free beer and soft drinks and donuts and coffee and seniors can get free rides and you can see Stephen Wonder, all these artists for free. How can you boycott that? But something about the movement that suggested never say never. It's driven at least as much by faith as by facts, because it's right. And that something about the struggle that says, if it's right, don't say no, even if the odds are great. And so we met it, pushed that Wednesday, And groups who don't order, who did not order their meat, said less walk out Chicago Fest. But Jesse, you took the role of being the artist, not across the picket line, the artist. We had contracts, but I knew in the bed. Bottom line is, we walked out Chicago Fest. Harold Washington came out one day and said, I don't want to run for mayor, but if you insist, his way of putting us down was, I tell you what, if you get 50,000 new voters and raise $250,000, allow me to build a coalition with only one black person running out to consider. He knew those were standards he thought we couldn't reach. Well, the boycott was so successful, artists didn't cross our lines. And what happened was that we put on almost 400,000 voters, raised maybe $500,000, and Harold was running.
Harold Washington was a congressman from Chicago. We had broken with the machine, but was not sure he wanted to go.
That's right. And we were excited about running, and we thought we could win. We got a rumor that Ted Kennedy and Mondale were coming to town to support Harold, to support Jane Brennan and Daley to defeat Harold. We couldn't imagine that two liberal allies who had, you know, cheered us on, said all the right things, gave all the right accolades and speeches, but undermined our move for empowerment for the franchise. So we put together a petition of 100 names, Willie Brown, Maxine, Mrs. King, all these names, and Ted and Mondale, the fact, you know, we're with you, but Jane Brennan and Dela are allies. What do we fit in this? I said, someone has to run against these guys in the primary. We're using the limits of liberalism. We're interested in liberation, not just liberalism. We can't be the flip side of the Republican coin. We need to get another rail, a third rail, a rail of change, a rail of hope. So I said, someone has to run to open the process up. And honestly, I was not thinking about running. I talked with Andy Young, and they came to my house.
Well, let's be clear here so people.
This is 83.
In 83, Harold Washington ran.
Right.
He beat him. He got elected mayor.
He got elected mayor, and the regular Democrats, just as the Democrats in the South, lived with the likes of George Wallace, blocked doors. Mm-hmm. The Democrats of Chicago, likewise, was the oppressive force in Chicago.
And they had the national folks sought to prevent.
The national party, they saw.
And it was at that point that you started thinking, we may need to make a national move.
Indeed I did, because I was so disappointed that they would come into Chicago, not to support us. After all, these were the guys who were our guys as we fought against the machine and the 1968 oppressive mm-hmm. police brutality tactics. And so when that happened, Anderson said, well, I won't run because I'm not quite ready to do that.
Andrew Young. Former ambassador to the United Nations.
They said to Maynard Jackson, Maynard, former mayor, Maynard, you should run. I was really pushing him to run. Mm-hmm. Maynard said, I've been in the public office, I'm now trying to start a business for my family. We were doing a Southern campaign registration. At some point, people said, run, Jesse, run. And it got louder and louder. And at some point, if I had not run, it would have been like I was playing with the people. Mm-hmm. I was not sincere. It was not about me. It was about fulfilling the agenda, Dr. King's agenda. That our civil rights struggle had been marginalized, and even liberals, our allies, had abandoned it. So I felt the way to get our agenda on the table to get on the stage and take to the stage the issues of our time. And in that context, I decided to run and then call upon those protesting forces for social change to use their collective energy to turn from protest, politics, and fighting, to get on the stage and make sure that our issues got on the stage. But without someone on the stage, we could not get our issues on the table, but we were able to find them.
But you were not, I mean, when you started saying, oh, I'm thinking of running for president of the United States, you were not treated particularly seriously by a lot of the folks who usually vet a political process.
Well, first of all, a lot of the blacks thought it was absurd. You can't, and this has not happened before you, in a big way, you can't do this. I remember Reginald Lewis, late Reginald Lewis of Beatrice Foods, a very successful businessman. Reggie said, when he heard the idea I was going to run, he's a Harvard law graduate. I said, this is some shit. You can't run. You can't win. All you can do is to defeat some liberal. Well, I meant to defeat whoever was running, of course. But it was like a cultural breakthrough. And he said, one night, while he said these things rather publicly, he was up at 3 o'clock in the morning writing, preparing his plan to take over Beatrice Foods at that time, to take over the sewing company he was buying. He said, he looked at me sitting there at Harvard debating. He said, if Jesse Jackson can do this, I can figure this thing out. It's like it hit him a certain kind of way. Another woman called in WLIB one day, and they were debating, could I run and what would it mean? And she called in her own ungrammatical and profound way and said, talking about winning, he'd be winning every damn he on TV without a basketball. He'd be winning, he'd be baiting the missions. I mean, he'd be winning just by being there. It was like something had begun to happen in people's minds. And I had been an organizer for some time. I reached out and the word rainbow came on. Rainbow came on.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this notion of people, today, rainbow coalition is such a, or rainbow in politics is such a common phrase. We assume it's always been associated with politics as opposed to the sky.
No, what happened was, I had been to several conventions where you hear about the African Americans protesting, trying to get on the agenda. Here were the Native Americans fighting for their dignity. Here were the Latinos fighting for some issue of language or their dignity. A woman protesting, a gays protesting, a workers protesting, a peace activist protesting. As all of those together, they equal a rainbow. And there are more of us outside the convention than inside the convention. Why don't we just organize that coalition and affirm our common ground agenda, which was Dr. King's agenda, which was that we have basic public accommodations, a job, health care, an income for every American. It meant that our basic platform thrust. It became a rainbow coalition. And the regular party was slow to reach out to include those persons because for many politicians, an organized minority is a political majority. They do not want growth, they want control. They don't want a lot of people involved in the process. They really want control, not growth. And so it was in that context that we ran and we made one of our primary focus areas was voter registration. Indeed, Southern black voter registration, which was the key to Democrats regaining the South. So, and we put on 2 million new voters, and in 86, one byproduct of the campaign was at the height of Reagan's popularity. Democrats regained the Senate in the South. Mm-hmm. Only Sanford in North Carolina got as much as 41% of the vote white. I mean, people like Graham, the senator from Louisiana, Bro, all that group came in the way of this new...
A majority of the votes that elected them being African-Americans. And really, that registration drive was in many ways an extension of the civil rights movement because while voting rights had come in 65, many people had never had either the courage or the encouragement or whatever it took to actually register.
Jose Williams, I would argue that we left the South, he argued, and came to Chicago too soon, that the unregistered black Southern voter was the key to the kingdom. That was his belief. Somewhere between the Operation Breadbasket, urban economic movement on the one hand, and Southern registration, he felt was the other key. So we were doing the tour across the South, putting on those new voters, and of course, we argued two things early on. One, that we had to expand our base to include progressive white women. And so I argued one of the points was that if Golda Meir could guide Israel in a time of war, and Margaret Thatcher could guide Britain, and India could guide India, the world's largest democracy, a woman should be on the ticket. Even the women who would not support my candidacy couldn't be against that idea. And the success of our candidacy emboldened women to demand something, which was to get a woman on the ticket, which was Geraldine Ferraro. So Ferraro being on the ticket was a product of that campaign. Democrats were getting the Senate in 86 was a product of that campaign. Well, by 88 become people, as a just the fact that a black can be on the stage and can argue economic, political, foreign policy issues, we had begun to pierce the ceiling of what was possible, a foretaste of things to come.
When you finished in the 84 campaign, did you think, I'm gonna just keep right on going and run in 88, or did you think somebody else might pick it up and take it?
I was a bit hesitant to go forward because I really had not thought through that process, and yet we were being at that time strongly encouraged to continue because many who did not support us in 84, even many black politicians, they saw our winning their districts and their cities, they could support us and become delegates.
At the very least, you could get them to the convention.
They could support us and the increased registration could elect them to positions that never could win before, because that we were building both registration base and coalition base. And that began to appeal to them in a very different kind of way. But we were also, the first time we had the convention with our own trailer, our own floor plan, our own dignity in the process, really, for the first time. And by 88, when we did it again, issues that we'd begun to make common, the idea of going to high schools, every high school senior is eligible to register and vote, those who'll be 18 by November that following year. The blacks got the right to vote, reaffirming 65. The next year was argued by Dr. King and others that if teenagers could fight in the Vietnam, they could also register and vote. Mm-hmm. That piece came up. By 75, Latinos the voting beyond just English only. So that was in the wake of the 65 movement, but it had kind of come, you know, to a standstill, and we were not really making progress. So by 88, we doubled the vote because our enthusiasm had gotten higher.
Let me ask you about something you did between 84 and 88, because I want to focus in on 88. But in 1987, there was the National March for Gay and Lesbian Rights in Washington. Now, I have heard this year, it's interesting to talk about the current presidential race, with people saying, well, you know, it's pretty incredible that Barack Obama, who is running a very serious campaign for the presidency this year, has been able to, or at least done some things to try and combine the black church with gays and lesbians. The same, get people on the same stage in that. And it seems that people have forgotten that you bridged some of those gaps and got people talking to each other in 1984 and in that period afterwards. You marched in that gay and lesbian march. And that was one of the most complex aspects of the Rainbow Coalition. You didn't.
Well, the idea was, what do we have in common? How do we move from racial and religious and gender battleground to economic common ground? And my argument was, if you were a rural farmer in Iowa, you didn't know the urban worker in Chicago. You thought they were not working because they were lazy, because you'd seen television. And you were getting farm subsidy because you wanted to melt the government too. So you had these feelings about each other. You thought they didn't want to work, they thought you didn't want to farm. In fact, both of you wanted to do it, but you were being squeezed out by some bigger forces. And so it became, our argument was, if the plant closes and globalizes capital without globalizing human rights and workers' rights, and jobs and capital leave, and drugs and guns come, and they turn the lights out, we all look amazingly similar in the dark. In the dark, if you are gay or straight or black or white or male or female or brown, you look so much the same in the dark. He is not black and white. It's wrong and right. It's dark and light. What do we have in common that links us? And so we have a way at the common issues that connected us. And so many church people began to affirm, he tells us, humanity. My premise at that point was human rights for all human beings. Make room for your neighbor. Human rights for all human beings. So we were intentionally building bridges of unusual alliance between rural farmer and urban worker and gay and straight and black and white. Indeed, male and female in terms of political movements. And so now I must say, when I look on TV and see an African American, a Latino, and a woman running a kind of rainbow assortment of people running, as of course this can happen. It was not of course in 84. It was, I mean, can they black run? And should you run? And can you compete? Can you discuss foreign policy? The great issues that we discussed at that time, thought to be controversial, because they were controversial, are now center stage. Garvey, when I raised the point about the content that was saying that ANC was a terrorist organization and South Africa was a democratic republic, he said, no, South Africa is a terrorist state, ANC, fighting for democratic rights. And I mentioned Mandela and the ANC in the 84 campaign speech. Most folks had never heard of ANC before Free South Africa at that time. And so I was able in my lifetime to see our nation change from embracing South Africa as an apartheid government to embracing Mandela.
And your campaign played out. The people need to remember that historical perspective. Your campaign played out 84 to 88, that period, was when the anti-apartheid movement came to America.
Well, in some sense. And also, I made the case that in the Middle East, that that cannot be Israeli security without Palestinian justice. That Israelis and Palestinians had to coexist and not co-annihilate. And that meant a two-state solution. Well, I almost lost my citizenship behind that position. Now, of course, it's, of course, that's what we do. Argue the case at the time that we had to take a renewed look at the flow of drugs in our country. We saw the drugs was kind of a recreational something for a few people. I saw drugs as being very mainstream, decadent form of chemical warfare. Because I was spending a lot of time in high schools and jails. I saw drugs on as an economic flow and a cultural flow with great depth and breadth even then. And so real politics didn't deal with drugs. We deal with real stuff. HB4, 5, and HB10. Now, drugs is real stuff, you know. So we raised it. We went on the cutters out on the at the
Coast Guard,
where the drugs were coming in, and we had no defense against the drug flow. And so when I looked at the issue of Free South Africa and the Middle East two-state solution, issue of a job and income for every American, issue of reinvesting our infrastructure, a bridge collapse in Minnesota, Liberty collapse in New Orleans, both ends of the Mississippi River, because we didn't invest in our infrastructure. And with Felix Warrington, who had built the plan to build out in New York, who was our advisor at that point, that issue was unheeded, and we paid a big price for not investing in our infrastructure. So the issue of voter registration to keep the growth, the result of that is, I might add, that increased registration became the way the Democrats got the Senate back in 86, how we won New York in 89, Virginia in 89, Seattle, Washington in 89. Bush and Dole got more white votes than Clinton. Mm-hmm. Well, Clinton got more white than rainbow votes than they got. We won by registration. Republicans won by nullification. We won by increasing registration. They won by nullifying those votes.
Well, it's sort of an interesting thing. It's one of the things that while you have not run for president since 1988, it's an interesting thing that every election cycle, a couple weeks out from the election, the Democratic president, the candidate for president, wants you on the campaign trail. He wants you to close the deal.
The key to the kingdom really is more votes. And if you lock him out of the primary, you may very well lock him out the general. And my point was and is now that 92 and 96, we won the Senate in 86 and the White House in 92 and 96 by increased registration. And so Republicans decided, let's target that vote, since that vote is the key to winning. So in 2000, they came up targeting that vote with Ms. Harris and the Florida scheme, the Florida, I mean the Texas
recount fight
prisoner scheme. So we put on maybe 3,000 new voters in Florida A&M, and those voters or vote did not count. Bush became president by 527 or 512 votes. They won by nullification. In Ohio, they won by nullification. And the result is, I mean, Bush and Musharraf have one thing in common, and Bush and I have one thing in common. Both of us came in second. Bush and Musharraf have something in common. Both of them made president by Supreme Court. Ooh.
Yeah. Let me take you back to 88. There's so much to talk about here, but I wanna focus in on something you mentioned with foreign policy. And one of the things that gave you credibility as a presidential candidate, as somebody who never held public office, was your ability to go to other countries where America seemed to be in crisis, Syria, Cuba, and make things happen. And you've said to me that you recognized that people around the world see African Americans as folks they can talk to, as a community they can relate to. And you recognize that at a point where you were able to go and make things happen and make the American media see you very differently.
Why does the world see Brother King so differently than American presidents? They see him as embodying their struggle at home, his struggle to overcome occupation, or colonialism, our segregation, our apartheid, our poverty, is the world's struggle. After all, we are, as a nation, we are 6% of the world's population. We're 6%. And the some republics are about 6%. And half of all human beings in Asia, half of them are Chinese. Most of them are poor. 1/8 of the human race is African, 1/4 Nigerian. There are billion people in India, twice more than the U.S. and the Russian republics combined, about 600 million of very, very poor people. In our own hemisphere, 2/3 of our neighbors speak Spanish. English is a minority language in our hemisphere. So most people in the world today, in the globe, are yellow, brown, black, non-Christian, poor female and young men don't speak English. In that world, they get many signals from the black struggle to humanize and civilize our country. They gain from us a kind of what's possible. So kids at Tiananmen Square singing "We Shall Overcome." Kids in Sharpeville, South Africa singing "We Shall Overcome." In Gdansk, Poland, they were singing "We Shall Overcome." We did not realize, because we were so local unto ourselves, just how global was the impact of our struggle. And so when I would go to, we were in a meeting in Memphis, Tennessee, and Reagan had derided Carter about spending so much time trying to get American hostages out of Iran at that time. We figured if Reagan would gain favor by saying Carter spent too much time trying to get American hostages free, what would he do for two soldiers, a black and a white? The white one died. So Goodman might be there for a long time.
This is in Syria.
We said, well, why? Let's try to get, let's call the embassy.
This is in 1983.
83.
Just you were talking about running for president.
We'd announced by the time.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd do something daring and right to further get real attention. And so the White House said, President Reagan said, in effect, you shouldn't go. You don't know what you're doing. But you have the right to go. If you get him, bring him back to the White House.
Because we'll post a picture.
If you don't get him, it'll prove you don't know what you're doing. That's a deal. Got to Syria and took a coalition of people. The U.S. ambassador was at the airport. They knew something could happen. We were in Syria. And I had met with Assad some years ago when I was there, meeting with Israelis and Palestinians. And I had met Assad at that time, and I had met Sadat at that time. I had some familiarity with the zone, and said to him, you should release this prisoner. He's not here to fight the war. His falling here was accidental. He was lost. He was not here fighting the war against you, and that to release him is a wonderful opportunity. He said, yes, I can't do it, because he's a soldier. My people were offended by his being here, and we don't have communication with the U.S. government. I said, but you let him go shows a humane side of you and your government. We went back and forth.
So here you are negotiating with a global leader, with only the authority of...
Well, moral authority. and trying to establish trust between people. Someone once said, pointed out that the Reagan didn't do the good government. So I tried. I talked. I asked, you know, and so we went back and forth, and finally he said, you know, I'm almost persuaded. And I said, you know, thinking about Paul and Agrippa arguing in the biblical sense, I said, to go from almost to altogether persuaded, let him go. Jesse, I can't do it because it's the Christmas season, and all my guys are across Europe, across the world on vacation, and I can't. I said, so if I had to hire one lawyer in Syria, it would be you. Let the man go. Can't do it. And I sensed that something was happening, and I came back to the hotel, and Bob Fall from CBS News was doing the report. Jackson is coming to Syria in a naive way. Nothing has happened. There's egg on his face. He was talking about the egg on my face, which was pretty delectable meal, that, by the way, egg on your face. And by the time I got in the hotel room, the foreign minister came in, rushed behind me and said, come back to see Mr. Assad quickly. Went back real quick and only bring two people with you. And we got back real fast, and he said, you can have with them. I brought our doctor there with examining him in the jail. We really developed some relationship with Goodman by that time. And we brought him back. I sensed something big had happened, that we had opened up our line. And I got back to Germany, the plane stopped, we got back to the States. I was waiting to hear the journal ask me, what did I done to break through? How had we convinced Assad, given U.S.-Syria relations, what had I done to appeal, to convince him it was worth the risk? What had I done, the president had not done? Reverend Jackson, who paid the hotel bill? I was worried it was something profound. I wanted to change my foreign policy.
Did a light go on with regard to the media at that point?
Who paid the hotel bill? Then we brought Goodman to the White House, and President Reagan, to his credit, he convened his whole cabinet. In fact, and he said, explain what happened. I explained what happened. And he said, what can we do to help? I said, call Assad and say thank you. And they called Assad. Reagan said thank you. They started talking. They never stopped talking. The one victory in that was Reagan called Assad to say thank you for releasing a soldier. And they kept talking. That was a product. They went out the door, and then there was a program on the lawn of the White House. And President Reagan said it was a great deal, and he thanked me and all that. And then the program was over. So I haven't had anything to say. So I stopped talking too.
You grabbed that microphone.
I said, I brought the guy home. Let me say something. But what I found, whether it was a Syria, bringing Americans home from Cuba, Iraq, or Yugoslavia, as the case may have been, I found something insistent about in each of those cases. In each case, we looked upon those countries with contempt, mm-hmm. and not respect.
The United States.
Yeah, as a government. Two, we had some form of no-talk policy toward them. We think no-talk is great leverage. Thirdly, in each instance, I met with religious leaders in those countries. We seem to underestimate the impact of religious leaders in those countries. The fourth thing we seem to disregard is the abounding poverty in those countries. And the fifth thing, it seems, is that beyond the poverty, is that we have intelligence deficits about the cultural issues. That's what I found in each case. So when we in fact do talk as opposed to no talk, we are sensitive to their religious concerns. We are concerned about poverty of the people, not just power with the leader. We can make things happen. Often diplomacy does not work because we don't try it. But we don't give ourselves a chance to think it through because we want to shoot it out.
Do you think that the people got that before the media and the political class did?
The people?
American people. At least some of them, because it seemed that was, when you were doing this citizen diplomacy, you were having breakthroughs, you were achieving things, but you were still not getting a lot of credit. in the media or the political
field. Well, being on that, to the extent that Mr. Kissinger said that American security was in the triangle of crisis, I'd like to call it, Iran, Israel, and South Africa. We had to keep these three. This is the arc of security. And we lost Iran, Israel, or South Africa. We lose our entire security blanket, and plus the Indian Atlantic Oceans come together at the tip of South Africa. It's clear to me the problem of the Shah was not in our national interest and could not, that lie couldn't last forever. We had great interest in Israeli security, but that was, Israeli security and Palestinian justice are kind of one the same. That's why the two-state solution is what they're working on right now. And we had no future in apartheid South Africa. So Iran failed and South Africa failed. And Kissinger is still a foreign policy expert. He was wrong. I was right. In the apartheid in South Africa and two-state solution in the Middle East and ending the Iran tyranny was our position. And yet somehow we're not quite expert yet. But the experts were wrong because they did not see with clear enough vision how the world sees us.
Let me ask you about it. After so much of this happened, between that 84 and the 88 campaign, the Democratic Leadership Council started. And there was a lot of effort to say, well, the Democratic Party has become too liberal. The Democratic Party has become too, started thinking along lines like you're talking about here, thinking about the world differently. And by any measure, this was a pushback against you.
It was.
And I remember you were disinvited. You weren't allowed to come speak at DLC events and things of this nature.
I spoke one time. I spoke there and gave a speech to DLC called The Light to Be United. So I hope we had in common. It's my last invitation.
You were more delighted than they were.
Well, the fact that I should put behind the incumbent, they didn't want the incumbent. They wanted to play push-off politics. So my speaking on the line to be united threatened their need to polarize. They were looking for the lost white male and never found it. Our future was not in white males who left, it was in new people coming in. And those who left would only be lured back on the base of their security. Economic security, a homeland security, not on some disc in the base, as the case may have been. And so DLC, and most of those who ran DLC, or were in a new base, they are now consultants.
Yeah, they're telling people how to.
They got beat. They ran away from our base, and did not recognize, it seems to me, that the young voter, the new voter, the female voter, the labor voter was, is the Democratic Party's vote.
Between 1984 and 1988, you doubled your vote. You got twice as many votes in 88. You won primaries across the country, 13 states primaries and caucuses, 7 million votes total. What was different about 84 and 88? What happened in 88?
We created more believers. I remember one night, the press, the Reverend, and some of the organizers said, you know, now that you're here, there's going to be a foreign policy debate tomorrow night. And foreign policy. And, you know, they were, you know, we know that you don't think about foreign policy. And so we don't want to embarrass it. If you don't show up, you'll be all right.
Really?
Yeah. And so I said, well, I'm anxious to be a part of the foreign policy debate. They said, what do you know about foreign policy? I said, we came here on the foreign policy. Slave trade was a foreign policy. I mean, labor is foreign policy. And so we went to those on another occasion, one after the, must have been 84, and the journalists had been with us for months, and maybe 88, and the night I had all my children speak. And one of the journalists came to me and she said, and she was crying, she said, they spoke so beautifully. Oh, I'm so surprised. I said, be delighted, not surprised. They were still assuming that somehow we were a symbolic trophy, not for real, not change agents. not capable of taking our nation to the next level. I think the real victories of those seasons was that we removed artificial roofs, began to remove doubt about what a woman could do, a person of color could do. And we can play ball together and fight wars together and pay taxes together. We can run the country together. And more we are convinced there's no one has in the supremacy domain on the thought process. And it hit me anew, I must say, and I was at the Super Bowl last year when the Bears played Indianapolis in Florida. And I saw basic white families from mid Indiana wearing Tony Dungy jerseys and the uniform numbers of black ball players. And so blacks from Chicago wearing the Urlacher jerseys as opposed to Peyton jerseys. And I thought, God, but 20 Super Bowls later, and once we're in the ready, we become a byproduct, you see, of these ball games on Saturday and Sunday, when Wisconsin plays Michigan, and when Detroit plays Chicago, you're pulling for uniform color, not skin color. That blacks from Wisconsin want far to embarrass black backs from Chicago.
Indeed.
Whites from Chicago want black backs to run past whites from Wisconsin.
Yes.
Because that 20 years of that has affected our thinking process more about how we see each other. And that's what has happened 20 years later, is that there is a new current of integrated thought processors that's changing many people's minds. And why do we do so well on the football field, basketball court, a baseball field? Whenever the playing field is even, and the rules are public, the goals are clear, hard work matters. While we have these ghettos and barriers, playing field is not even. Rules not public, goals not clear. Therefore, we have the structural inequality. So we want the same joy in school productivity, the same joy in labor productivity, same joy in healthcare that we get in watching football games, this even the playing field. That becomes our choice. And we didn't know how good football, baseball could be until everybody could play. We don't know how good healthcare can be until everybody can have some of it. We don't know how productive we can be until everybody can have a chance to learn to become productive citizens. And we, in some sense, we try to say that in 84 and 88, that let's even the playing. So today when I look up and see, Richardson and Rock and Hillary and Edwards from the South talking about the, you know, progressive white from the South, to me those are byproducts of our struggle to make this a more perfect union.
Well, isn't that really the ultimate play on this? Because you talk about sports and academics and all these other days, but really one of the most unlevel playing fields has been politics, right? We've had for a very long time, we've had a politics in this country that had a lot of closed doors. It was like that public library you saw when you were a kid.
Well, how representative is the Republican for the candidates? Is that really?
Well, you got Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney.
That's right.
There you go.
And since you mentioned Huckabee, I must say the thing I object to the most about that campaign is the attempt to make Romney take a religious test. I don't think that's fair. I mean, what group has the moral authority to give a religious test? I mean, do the conventional Christians who were against the abolitionist movement, can they beat their chest? Most lynchings took place after church on Sunday. They were not Mormons. Dr. King led it in Birmingham, to the white church, who would support our Republican congregations. Can those churches speak of being moral superior to Mormons? And so why are we still playing those kind of religious tests, gender tests, race tests, politics? And I would hope that people at large accept or reject him on the basis of his public policy. But we ought to stop giving people these religious, gender, and race tests. We're citizens, and we must be seen in that sense. The second point is, I think that this year's campaign has a challenge to connect the campaign, which is how you survive in a fairly elite circle after a while, how you connect the steering wheel with the tires. How did you, well, the campaign does not become a spectacle. You're looking at the campaign and say, when are they going to get to us? You look at the campaign and say, which one of them going to win? And is there a relationship between them winning and my situation? So when are they going to discuss the impact of subprime crime scandal, which is bringing down the global economy? We're discussing more and more about Iraq, and that's a good subject to discuss. But even when you bring the troops back home, 25% of the homeless are veterans, but you bring them back home
too. They can't buy a house.
And between the debt to China and the war expenditure and the subprime economic crisis, we're in for a long season of a recession, not a depression. And so I want them to discuss in more detail. All of them have positions taken out there on the subprime crisis. 2.2 million Americans in foreclosure, 10 million with subprime loans. And there must be some mass plan to restructure loans, not repossess homes, driven not by a health problem, unemployment, or job loss, but by a subprime product that, A, well, there was no bank regulation adequate. There was no transparency, and you know, they saw blind people bigger TV screens, and people had a product they could not afford to pay on the flip monies, and now we have a profound, serious, multi-trillion-dollar economic crisis, and I want to hear more of that, because whoever wins will inherit that challenge the first day.
You figured out how to talk about stuff like this. And one of the things of your campaigns that I see, you know, we talk about the what's come from your campaigns. But one of the lessons that didn't seem to get learned was that lesson of tapping into what people are worried about. In 1986, 87, you saw the farm crisis, and people said, well, you got Jesse Jackson can't go to farms. But you said, well, that's where the crisis is. I'm going to go there. Today you see the subprime crisis, you say the same thing. But what is it about most politicians that they don't get that you ought to go to the crisis and try and offer a solution rather than avoid the crisis?
I think it was two things. One is the survival. I could not outdo what they had become past masters at, talking in circles to each other. So I had to go to where they would not go, to either neutralize adversaries or gain the constituents. I had to go what I call points of challenge. That's one point. The civil rights struggles, which I come out of that tradition, has always been counterculture. Abolition of slavery was counterculture. Women's right to vote was counterculture. It was not the politic thing to do. Workers' right to organize was counterculture. Fighting for family farmers as opposed to just corporate farmers was counterculture. Fighting to clean up our environment, counterculture. Humanizing the AIDS health crisis was counterculture. The civil rights were counterculture. So I saw the flow of counterculture. Dr. King would put it this way. Vanity asked the question, is it popular? And we want to be accepted. We're human. Politics asks the question, would it work? Can it win? And conscience asks the question, is it right? And it may not be popular, not politic, but if it's right, you'll win ultimately. One has to be a long distance runner to be a change agent. This is not a campaign slogan. It must be a point of view And I must say, even the Republicans, they will invest in long-term strategists for a point of view. They may be wrong, at least they're clear. I mean, they basically have a point of view and they start the conclusion and they work backwards. They come back this way. And often we're not clear on, and I make the case today that there may be three areas that could be four of the missing points of Democrats. One would be a real, real investment in voter registration, not just in TV advertising. Because the key to our victory is more voters. And if they pull for you but can't vote for you, then you admire but you can't be followed. The second issue is the subprime crisis. I was in Prince George's County out from Washington Sunday. And that counted 14,000 foreclosures. 300,000 affected by the foreclosure. The tax and the equity value reduction of $3 billion. The size of the county's budget. Cleveland, 17,000 foreclosure, Greater Cleveland. Riverside, California, 17,000. Well, the 10 states, the most foreclosures, if you won those 10 states, you'd be within 10 votes of winning the Electoral College. You took the 10 states with the most foreclosures, you won those 10 states, California, Florida, Michigan, and so forth. Just those, with that crisis alone, you'd be within 10 votes of winning the Electoral College. You see, to me, you shouldn't miss that.
Yeah.
I'll count that.
So we got voter registration, we got focus on the subprime.
Urban policy, our infrastructure. I mean, to put America back to work, to rebuild, I mean, with the bridge collapsing in Minnesota and the levee in New Orleans, both ends of the Mississippi River, and schools collapsing, and inadequate housing, and the need to remove lead paint, and more of the green and the greening of America, it puts me back to work. And so a pronounced urban policy, not just I'm for it, but like campaign for reinvest in America and invest in it. It would cost to rebuild America and cost more for it to keep collapsing. The third one is, the reality is that the African American community is in a state of emergency. It's in a state of emergency. Nothing has happened to offset our structural deficit. 246 years of slavery when the hull of the ship. You end the 13th Amendment, it does not move us from the bottom. There's no freedom without equality. And then the 100 years of Jim Crow. They finally change the law, but does not change the structure of things. You get the right to vote, and as you vote, it does not. The people who are our allies in the movement to overcome barbarism, but not our allies in the fight for equality. So structurally, we won the right to end racial disparities in schools, but not to end funding disparities in schools. So you have Madison, you have Milwaukee. You have inner city, you have suburbs. And so today, 7 of 10 young black males in most cities don't finish high school. That's an American problem. In expulsion rates, blacks are 5 to 60% more likely to be expelled from school than white kids for the same infraction. These are America's children who are black. In New Jersey, a black kid is 60 times more likely to be expelled from school than a white kid, same infraction. 5 grams of crack cocaine, federal crime, 500 grams of powder probation. They're trying to modify that somewhat now, somewhat perhaps. In Illinois, 70% of all drug use are white, 10% are black. Jail, 66% black and 10% white. Whites with lawyers get probation and rehab and go to college and blacks go to jail.
I fear we may have beaten those numbers in Wisconsin.
Well, the point is that African Americans, highest infant mortality rate and shortest life expectancy. Most likely to be arrested. More time for crime. These are Americans whose best years of productivity are being sapped up in a jail industrial complex for profit. We must address that issue. One, the price you pay for ignoring it is not just moral.
You are listening to Citywide Radio's Friday Forum on WIDE 99.1 in Madison. We continue now with the concluding part of the program.
The subprime crisis that's now forcing banks to count down billions. The subprime crisis that now has asked European banks today, with 60 billion to save America's banks. What happened was our banks were allowed to attack the most vulnerable citizen with the subprime product. Water came in the hull of the ship. Unprotected blacks and browns is where the subprimes got targeted to. They were fair game to exploit them. More for cars, more for insurance, more for bank money, more for housing money. It was fair game to exploit those in the subprime zone. But at some point, that water kept rising and hit the captain's, hit the deck, and now the captain's table. In some sense, our ignoring vulnerable black and brown people and seniors let water in the boat that's now sinking the entire banking system of the world. Why are the European banks running to American banks? Because when Citigroup and Chase Manhattan, when these banks take a hit and the Rock, Northern Rock and Britain takes a hit, and Barclay takes a hit, and the bank in Germany takes a hit, and in France takes a hit, driven down by the American subprime crisis, how you treat the least of these affects the whole world. So just as our moral authority helped to gain us dignity, we are for democracy. But this is Selma democracy, not Philadelphia democracy. We're ending apartheid, but those who fought it did not fight to end it. We want justice. My point is that the treatment, the exposure to the unsolved racial crisis, leaving people of color unprotected, has now taken the whole ship. I really hope that you hear what I'm trying to say.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't hear that from any of the presidential candidates this year.
That is a sense that if you raise the racial justice question, you might scare white people away. Well, I submit this to you, that we are better because abolitionists fought, not because some of the politics of slavery. Good guys of a good treatment, bad guys of inhumane treatment. Good guys of abolition, not good treatment, a bad treatment, but no maltreatment, period. It was not politic. No political party embraced the Montgomery bus boycott. Although now it's a great thing.
Everybody loves it now.
No party sent a dime to the 7th Montgomery March for the right to vote. Everybody now. No party led the drive for women's right to vote. No party took the lead in workers' right to organize, workers' didn't kill the plant case. That's why the drive to make America better requires bold leadership. We'll go counterculture. Our future is in counterculture. Our present culture, too few got too much at the expense of too many. While I admire those who run and respect them and intend to participate, our future is in saying that if I am president, you will have a health care plan. Well, that's why I should vote. If I win, your child can afford to go to college. If I win, workers will have the right to organize, and then NLRB will not put them down. If I win, EEOC will be enforced. Contract compliance will be recognized. If I win, there'll be more schools and fewer jails. If I win, we'll reinvest in our infrastructure. If I win, we'll have peace in the world. I mean, given the politicians wrestle with these subjects, now I'm not being begrudged about any candidate, that's not my point.
My point is that I think in the end, the big idea makes us with, if I win, the union will win, and we'll abolish slavery. It's a big idea. If I win, there'll be a new deal, a fair deal. If I win, there'll be a new frontier. If I win, there'll be a great society. And I guess my struggle is, and our struggle in the rain was, is to fight with our allies to see that the risk in trying for the big idea is worth the risk. Those who play politics by leaders don't just mold opinion, follow opinion, but they mold opinion. And most campaigns are more poll conscious than change conscious. There's a tension between following opinion polls and molding opinion. And we sought, to the extent that we could, Ed, we sought to mold opinion. That's why our Paul Wellstone shows up.
Let's remind people that Paul Wellstone was one of your campaign coordinators in Minnesota. Bernie Sanders helped to run your campaign.
Paul Wellstone, Bernie Sanders, Ed Garvey. I mean, people who saw there was something about this and it made sense. Their longevity has outlasted a given campaign. And it's not enough for the candidate to win, the people must win. And I'm anxious for us to keep watering the root, not just water the leaf. Because you can have a great campaign that's just become who will entertain us best. Who has the best one-liner? Who has the best profile? Who has the best ad, the best counterattack ad? And you're just watching them perform. Somehow, you've got the feeling that if Roosevelt wins, we're going to come out of this depression thing. It's we got a stake in this thing. I remember my mother, one time I was a kid, grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, and mom, of course, didn't have the right to vote, was not involved politically. I saw all these I like Ike signs around town. And it was everywhere, because that's an even more conservative part of my state, upstate Greenville, where Bob Jones University is, this real firm university, very conservative. I like signs everywhere. So I remember saying, and I don't know why, I must have been 11, Mom, how are these I like Ike signs? She said, well, baby, it's the right guy, wrong party. And that didn't have meaning to me. She was saying, we're with the Roosevelt party thing. Because he's the guy that got us out of the depression. He's the guy that did the CCC. He's the guy that did these things. And this guy, Eisenhower, he is the wrong party. They're going to bring the boys back home. He's going to Korea. I mean, the idea of running, whatever his other agenda was, he's going to bring the boys back home from Korea, was an idea bigger than party. And I guess we have to keep pushing for that kind of idea. I think our candidates now are capable of getting there. But it must be pushed by the people. Our candidates will tend the jump if they see when they jump, they're going to land on soft grass, not land on cement. So people have an obligation. I mean, the candidates didn't decide the Montgomery Boys boycott. The people decided that. Mm-hmm. They didn't decide the March on Washington. That came outside the party. The people did not decide the Montgomery March. So even as we evaluate candidates, we have some obligation. We must rally for restructuring loans, not foreclosing homes. They'll catch up with us.
The candidates
they'll catch up. And when you have the demonstration big enough, they'll catch up and say, this is what I was trying to say all the while. when we declare that we want to deal with this urban policy, we want to address the subprime economic crisis, we want more public education, fewer public jails, we make that case, we'll have leadership emerge to explain what we were trying to say all the while.
And you will be making that case.
That's what we're going to do.
We've been at this for a while. We've talked about it a lot. I want to bring you around to in closing, a sense on your part. That 1988 campaign, which we are now going to be celebrating the 20th anniversary of, and 20 years can seem like a lifetime, or it can seem like a very short amount of time. But in your heart of hearts, inside of you, what do you think is the greatest legacy of that? What of the 1988 campaign do you think matters most?
We broke the mold of who and what was possible. I mean, after 88, women were confessing and Jackson and blacks could do that, we can't do it. Me Too kicked in. After that, if running is where you get leverage, then Richardson can say, we can get leverage that way too. This thing really is possible. This is not an exclusive stage club. Hillary Clinton can say, if that's possible, Barack can say, Barack told me one time, we were debating in Columbia, Mondale at the heart. And no matter what the question was, I said, but what about South Africa? I kept forcing the issue on the table. They started arguing about who had the beef and all that. I kept pressing our agenda. And he said he was a student in school.
Obama was a student watching that debate.
He said, well, I'm running for president. I think that what the legacy is, we removed artificial ceilings. We removed artificial ceilings and began to show what's possible. Now, they have one sees the American public in this campaign now that you see new possibilities emerging. You see some people who have now are becoming mature enough to rise above their fears about race and gender and choose their hopes about remedies and solutions. That more people now are willing to go to the doctor who can cure cancer no matter what his or her race may be, or gender may be. That more and more people are not willing to let whoever play quarterback that can pass and run and think, whatever his color may be. We see the maturing of America. Now that is this current of change. And you see how this gap between how Democrats see it in much broader terms, it seems. Republicans, in many ways, see it in different terms. But what we see on TV are these candidates. What we don't see is an undercurrent that remains very violent, very an ugly undercurrent that keeps undercutting the dream. And that becomes the struggle. Shall the current of hope prevail on the current of fear? Shall the current of new possibilities prevail, old tradition prevail? Shall the current of one big tent prevail? Are the undercurrent of us and them prevail? And we must win that tug of war, because when we win that, then we have a more perfect union. And in this world, there are not enough of us to leave good players on the bench because of the race or the gender or the religion. There's not enough of us to win this Olympic game with our best players in the stands and the dugout. There's not enough of us to do that. When you look at just the sheer, you know, the new president of Citigroup as an Indian, and I guess I met the president of a Harvard insurance company, he's an Indian. What I'm saying is that in the new world order, that more people get access to education and technology, you see a new global competition. And so if some of our best potential minds can't learn to compete, we can't win the big game. We're not beginning to lose Olympic basketball games. Because Europeans can play basketball too. But we're not beginning to lose track and field. Other people run too. So in the global world order, we cannot go to the big game. That basically is locked up. We cannot be in the big intellectual Olympics with our best minds never having learned the right to read, never having learned to read. So we must keep fighting for prenatal care, Head Start, and daycare on the front side, and not jail can welcome on the backside. Because it's morally right, but also our national interest is at stake.
Reverend Jensen. Please take your seats for one second. I want to do one brutal thing to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and that is to force him to listen for a second while our friend Steve Cobble, where is Steve Cobble? Steve Cobble comes up for one sec. Now, Steve isn't as famous as the Reverend, but Steve was one of the strategists for the Reverend's 1988 campaign. And one of the people who really did so much to put that campaign together. And one of the things that he has done is to calculate out what that campaign accomplished. And I just want to take a second here. It's not always easy to listen to somebody sing your praises, but Steve, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Cobble.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say my first peace march was on the streets downtown at UW, so it's nice to be back. Jesse Jackson, 84, won five primaries and caucuses, 3.5 million votes, 18.2% of the total primary vote, 384.5 convention votes in San Francisco. Jackson, 88, won 13 primaries and caucuses, plus the Texas caucus, which was split, 29% of the total primary vote. We put more people into caucuses that year than any other campaign. We won 1,218 and a half total convention delegates, which is the biggest number ever won by a runner-up. We pulled in over 7 million votes overall, which was more than Mondale had won the nomination with the time before. The same thing happened, by the way, in Wisconsin, where Reverend Jackson ran second, but got more votes than Gary Hart had won the state with the time before because of the huge interest and expanded turnout. We won the youth vote. We took the most diverse delegation to Atlanta in 1988 that has ever gone to a convention by far. 1 million new African American voters were registered in 84, and as Reverend Jackson mentioned, we won the big Southern races in 86, which took back the Senate and effectively ended the Reagan era. In 88, we registered another 1 million votes, and the follow-on to that was the first African-American Democratic Party chairman, Ron Brown, who led the party to victory 4 years later, the first African-American mayor of New York City, the first African-American mayor of Seattle and Durham, North Carolina, the first second African-American mayor of Cleveland, first African-American governor of Virginia, who won by 6,000 votes, clearly the benefactor of the thousands of new voters registered in two campaigns in Virginia, both of which Reverend Jackson won, by the way, in 84 and 88. The surprise election of Jackson State Chair Paul Wellstone in 1990, the only challenger to defeat a Republican incumbent that year. Bernie Sanders broke through as the first socialist candidate in modern times to win a House seat in Vermont, another white Jackson supporter. With the help of the 84 and 88 registrations and the new redistricting lines required under the Voting Rights Act, the minority members of the United States House doubled in size between 1990 and 1992. Plus, Carol Moseley Braun, another Jackson 88 delegate, became the first African-American woman ever elected to the United States Senate in 1992. And of course, the Reagan-Bush years were ended on the strength of African-American and Latino votes for Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996, and African-American and Latino votes elected Al Gore in 2000. As Reverend said, the nullification took it away. And I will end by just going back essentially 20 years ago. We're a month from Iowa. 20 years ago, a month after Iowa, the month of March was an incredible march, a month in the history of insurgent politics in this country. At the start of March, Jesse Jackson won more votes than anyone had ever won in a single day in Super Tuesday. He won five states that day. 4 days later, he won South Carolina by over 60% of the vote. He then came in second in Illinois, but Michael Dukakis, who was the other main competitor, got shut out of delegates, so Reverend Jackson actually took the delegate lead in the middle of March. We came in second in Kansas, although we found out later we'd put more caucus goers into the caucuses in Kansas, of all places, than Dukakis did. We didn't win as many delegates because of the way they were broken down by the districts. We won Puerto Rico a couple days later, and 6 days after that, we won a landslide victory in Michigan. At the end of March in 1988, a civil rights preacher who had met Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama, was leading the oldest political party in the history of the world in both delegates and votes. It was an incredible moment. The possibilities opened up, and yes, the establishment rallied together and beat us back a little bit, put us off a few years. But I don't know if that magic's ever going to have been captured since, and it really was a time when the possibilities became immense. And I was here in Wisconsin with Reverend Jackson, and I just want to end by thanking you for some of those crowds where, as a white, my impression there was thousands of whites coming out and saying, yes, you're all right, we're with you too. And it was an incredible moment that it was historic, and I want to thank you for it. And I want to thank John for giving me a chance to just come up here and talk. Thank you very much.
Let me say this, and we got the 1,200 delegates with $17 million. We got 1,200 delegates with $17 million and very little to advertise. Because we went for the people and not for the polls. So when I raised the concern tonight, sisters and brothers, that there are 2.2 million households facing foreclosure and eviction. And if my house is in foreclosure, your house next door loses value. Mm-hmm. In Prince George's County, if the 13,000 homes are foreclosed, and you lose $3 billion in value, then you can't pay teachers and policemen and firemen and public transportation. If the economy is in that kind of shape, I say go there. If tonight there are 2.2 million Americans in jail, a million of black men, we cannot take lightly what it means to have them in the citizens of one constituency group in jail. There's some structural default here. And so I say, let's do the right thing for the right reasons. We have every reason to be proud of our nation. But what makes our nation great is its people standing up. Dr. King would often say, what makes America great, not that we're always right, we have the right to fight for the right. We should never be guilty of betrayal of silence. Speak up. Let them hear you. This land is our land. Thank you very much.
Now, a special award for the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
First, we want to present a plaque, actually, to Capital Times first. So, this is a scroll of honor to the Capital Times newspaper. We thank you for your 90 years as a leading and courageous voice in Wisconsin in pursuit of social justice, truth in the news, and integrity in publishing. presented this 12th day of December, 2007 in Madison, Wisconsin. And this is by Umoja Malele Chakasa Anana, Pastor David Smith with the African American Council of Churches, Dr. Harris, who's not with us here, with Genesis Development Center, Ken Black, the president of 100 Black Men, Johnny Winston Jr., elected member of Madison School Board, and myself, Nidra Bobo, president of the African American Black Business Association. Capitalism.
To extend my congratulations to the Capital Times for their 90th birthday. Well, this role of honor for the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We thank you for being a passionate preacher of the word. We thank you for being an advocate of democracy. We thank you for working courageously on our behalf, presented this 12th day of December, 2007 in Madison, Wisconsin, by Umoja Magazine, Malele Chakasa Anana, Pastor David Smith, African American Council of Churches, Dr. Richard Harris, Executive Director of Genesis Development Corporation, Ken Black, President of 100 Black Men, Johnny Winston Jr., elected member of Madison School Board, and Nidra Bobo, President of the African American Black Business Association. Reverend Jackson, congratulations. Thank you so much.
Let me say, first of all, thank you so much. January the 5th through the 9th, we're having a Rainbow Push Wall Street Summit Conference, Economic Summit Conference, driven in the main by the subprime scam. And you who present there, well, I want to have a strong Madison presence in New York on that occasion. We're all welcome, but we're going to convene during that time, mayors and state reps and the like will begin to negotiate with lenders to save borrowers' homes, to renegotiate deals. We're going to convene business people at that time. And I urge you, on this past Monday, we marched in 50 markets around the country, marching on the countrywide of the world to renegotiate people's homes savings plans. So I want Madison to be in that mix so that we are, so I really want Madison to be a part. It's a very cold town with a very warm heart. Thank you so much.
let me just say that the reality of the Reverend Jesse Jackson is that even when we try to honor him, he can't get away from politics and the issues. Would that all of our presidential candidates would always have that conundrum. And to paraphrase Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. Over that direction, thank you so much to all of you for being a part of this.